taking a new bus route. You're going to hear a conversation between a driving instructor and a trainee. Listen carefully. Mark on the map the route the bus is going to take and the stops it has to make. You have to find Victoria Station before you start listening.
Now you're used to driving the double-decker, we'll try a different route.
Oh, right.
This time, I want you to practice stopping at bus stops as well. When you come out of the terminus of Victoria, turn left down Buckingham Palace Road, then at the fork, turn right into Pimlico Road. There's a bus stop about halfway along, opposite a church.
I didn't quite catch that. Opposite a what?
A church. On your right, that is. At the end of Pimlico Road, cross over into Royal Hospital Road and stop again outside the Royal Hospital. At the end of Royal Hospital Road, go up Flood Street, then left into the King's Road and stop outside the Town Hall. Traffic's often bad on the King's Road and it's always very crowded, so you'll need to watch out for pedestrians.
Okay. Where next?
Carry on down the King's Road until you get to Edith Grove.
Did you say Edith Grove or Edith Road?
Edith Grove, okay? Turn right up there and carry on up Redcliffe Gardens. Stop just before you get to the Brompton Road. You'll see the bus stop near the corner.
Sorry, could you repeat that?
Yes. There's a bus stop just near the corner of Brompton Road. Turn right onto the Brompton Road and then left up Gloucester Road. Stop outside the big hotel.
Sorry, which did you say, opposite or outside?
Outside it. You can't miss it. It looks like a skyscraper. Next, right into Cromwell Road and carry on till you reach the museums. Stop outside the Victoria and Albert. Continue up the Brompton Road to Knightsbridge and then to Hyde Park Corner. We won't go up Park Lane to Marble Arch yet. That'll be a real test of your skill as a driver. We'll go back to the terminus via Grosvenor Place and Grosvenor Gardens.
So when do I get to take the bus around Marble Arch?
Oh, next week. Maybe.
Before you listen to the passage, have a discussion on the questions you hear on the tape. Do you think colors sometimes affect your feelings and emotions? If so, cite some examples. What are your color preferences? Why?
The fact that blind people can see things using other parts of their bodies apart from their eyes may help us to understand our feelings about color. If they can sense colour differences, then perhaps we too are affected by colour unconsciously. Manufacturers have discovered by trial and error that sugar sells badly in green wrappings, that blue foods are considered unpalatable, and that cosmetics should never be packaged in brown. These discoveries have grown into a whole discipline of colour psychology that now finds application in everything from fashion to interior decoration. Some of our preferences are clearly psychological. Dark blue is the color of the night sky and therefore associated with passivity and calm, while yellow is a day color with associations of energy and incentives. For primitive man, activity during the day meant hunting and attacking, which he soon saw as red, the color of blood and rage and the heat that came with effort. So it was natural that green, the complementary colour to red, should be associated with passive defence and self-preservation. Experiments have shown that colours, partly because of their psychological associations, also have a direct physiological effect. People exposed to bright red show an increase in respiration rate, heartbeat, and blood pressure. Red is exciting. Similar exposure to pure blue has exactly the opposite effect. It is a calming colour. Because of its exciting connotations, red was chosen as a signal for danger. But closer analysis shows that a vivid yellow can produce a more basic state of alertness and alarm. So fire engines and ambulances in some advanced communities are now rushing around in bright yellow colours that stop the traffic dead.
Exercises. Complete the research report according to what you hear on the tape.
It could not stay alive. It would not be true to say it can do nothing for itself. For it can breathe, suck, swallow, digest, and excrete, and protest by crying when uncomfortable or hungry. But that's about all. Indeed, you can say that in the early months of life, the infant has hardly come out of the womb. It dislikes being born, and dislikes the world into which it has been thrust. The fear experienced at birth later recurs in nightmares, in which one passes through a narrow tunnel with a sense of suffocation. This has been proved by tracing back such nightmares to their origin. Similarly, the horror of the wide open space confronting the newborn child recurs in nightmares of being alone. The infant, disliking the cold, uncomfortable world into which it has been so roughly thrust, turns away from it as soon as possible and sinks again onto its mother's bosom to recover the state of passivity. It wants to be left at peace. It wants to stay put. If it could, it would put up a notice not to be disturbed. It does not like to be moved. That's why it is quite content to be in the cot or in the mother's arms. All that it asks is that it shall not be moved from the one to the other. Transition is what an infant objects to, relapsing into calmness only when restored to quiescence. But while the infant does not like to be moved from place to place, it welcomes movement of a sort. It likes to be gently rocked, whether in the mother's arms or in the cot. Indeed, the infant of the South Sea Islands will sleep peacefully, bound by a shawl to the mother's back, while she works in the fields. Why is this? Because movement means that someone is near and is therefore reassuring, whereas absolute silence and stillness may mean aloneness and desertion. Quite frequently, then, when the infant is crying in the cot, a mere rocking, indicating the presence of the mother, or still more, the mother's voice, is enough to reassure it, and it stops crying. Evidence of the infant's dependence and helplessness is easy to find, first in sleep. In the first months, the infant sleeps 60% of its time, and out of the remaining 40%, 99% is spent in dozing. So that we may say it spends practically the whole of its first month in sleeping and dozing. By the time it is 12 months old, it sleeps and dozes half of its time and spends a quarter in quiet displeasure. The infant's dependence is also shown in its need to be in close contact with the mother. This need has its origin in the deep-rooted urge which makes an organism keep in close contact with a mother body. This urge makes it snuggle close to its mother and want to be cozy, to be nursed and cuddled. This contact gives it a sense of protection and security. It also gives it sensuous pleasure, and this further encourages the activity. But the biological urge is more primitive than the sensuous pleasure which comes to be associated with it. The old-fashioned nannies understood this need and tucked up an infant in its cot, and in this state it felt more secure and slept more peacefully. The helplessness of an infant is also illustrated by its cry of distress. For instance, when it falls or is disturbed by a loud noise or is separated from its mother, the function of the cry is to call the attention of the mother to relieve the distress. It is therefore well to remind parents that an infant does not cry unless something is wrong. The cry is not intended simply to annoy the mother. If the mother does get annoyed, the child may well stop crying, but this is because it finds that crying makes things worse by calling the attention of evil, hostile forces to itself. Then, instead of crying, the child may fall into a silent anxiety. The mother is then satisfied by its quietness. The infant is not. It lies in a state of terror.
Exercises. Complete the statements according to what you hear on the tape.